My name is Charles Baxter. My book is Blood Test, a Comedy.
National Book Award finalist Charles Baxter is best known for his novels, essays, and poetry. His latest work is titled Blood Test, a Comedy. It's certainly comedic, but with an eerie spin. Protagonist Brock Hobson is an average guy who takes a blood test that indicates he's predisposed to commit acts of violence. This test not only examines his blood, but also his internet history and responses to a detailed questionnaire. I spoke with Charles Baxter about comedic writing and how he took a cue from some of the real-world businesses that predict our future actions in order to make money. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Charles Baxter. I'm a bit intimidated right now. You have a very impressive backlist. I have six of your books on my shelf right now, but I think I'm most intimidated because I've never learned the proper usage of who and whom. If I misuse who or whom, will you please correct me?
I'm not so sure I would do that. My character in the novel does such things, but in real life, I don't do that.
Okay. Well, could you give our listeners a brief description of Blood Test and maybe what got you thinking about this idea for a premise?
Sure. Blood Test is a novel about a guy who goes to a doctor for an ordinary exam and discovers, because his doctor tells him, that there is a new blood test that has been developed by a company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that analyzes your genetic structure, analyzes your internet history, takes a questionnaire from you, and then predicts your behavior, not just what diseases you're likely to come down with, but what in fact you are likely to do. And without giving too much away about the novel, he agrees to do this because he himself feels that he's a very ordinary guy, very much a character who's used to habits. His kids tell him that he's as predictable as a metronome, and he submits to this test, and the results come back, and the results are predicting that he may indulge in some violent crime. The idea for the novel came to me in two ways. I started writing it during the pandemic because I wanted to write a novel that would lift people's spirits and would make them laugh. I thought people already felt so bad that I didn't want them to feel any worse than they already did. And the other thing that I noticed that was a kind of inspiration was that when I went on to various websites, such as Amazon and others, they were predicting what they thought I would or I should buy. And it occurred to me that there are a lot of companies, a lot of corporate, not just corporations, there are quite a few cultural entities that would like to know what we are going to do before we do it, and who are in the business of trying to predict our actions before we perform them. So out of those two things, this novel got itself written.
You know, you mentioned, and it says right on the cover, that Blood Test is a comedy. But that doesn't prevent, you know, some deep thought questions about some serious subjects in the book. You know, fidelity, homosexuality, nationalism, gun violence. How can comedy breach some of these topics in a way that a work that takes itself seriously might not be able to do?
Well, first of all, I think that comedy brings people together rather than separates them, or certain kinds of comedy will do that. If we can all find the same thing to laugh at, we may find our differences less larger than we thought they were. And I also think that comedy lowers our defenses. We feel less belligerent. I mean, I know there's one theory of comedy that says that there's a kind of cruel comedy. Freud thinks that that's true. that laughter is always based in a kind of meanness, a kind of cruelty. But I don't really think that that's always the case. So I thought that if I wrote a book about certain features in our cultural life and exaggerated them so that they became close to ridiculous, but still within the realm of believability, that I might have a good premise for a novel.
Let's talk about self-fulfilling prophecies for a moment and meeting expectations. Brock Hobson was the most predictable human being. As a guy who worked in insurance, he assessed risk on a daily basis. It was part of his identity. Yet one suggestion from this company, from this blood test, and something shifted where Brock started to act in ways that make this expectation come true. And at one point, Trey said to Brock, "It was almost like you were trying to fulfill a prophecy from Generomics." And then there's also Joe's behavior beginning to like lift weights based on Bert's expectations of what Joe should be like. Can you talk to me about this idea of meeting expectations and self-fulfilling prophecies?
Yes, although it's a wonderful question, but it's a very complicated one. Because I think that the first time that you are exposed to predictions about who you are and what you're going to be is probably in high school and college. Your parents have certain, let's say, expectations about you, or at least sometimes they do. Your advisors, your teachers in school say, "Oh, I think you would make a wonderful X, whatever that might be." And you're certainly free, and many young people are free to reject these ideas. But if somebody says, "Well, you know, you'd make a wonderful doctor," you go home and you think, "Well, maybe I would become a wonderful doctor." Now, in literature, it's the case that when something is predicted about a character, let's say in Shakespeare's Macbeth, the three weird sisters say, "Macbeth, you're going to become a man of great consequence and power." Macbeth thinks, "Oh, that's interesting. Maybe I will." And maybe the way to do that is through crime. I mean, if you go to a fortune teller and the fortune teller says you're about to fall in love, does that open you to the possibility of falling in love? Maybe it does. Maybe it does. Anyway, I think a story can be premised on that possibility. Someone tells you you're about to be or to do something, and it predisposes you to that very possibility.
Can we talk about names for a moment? Because for naming a normal guy, Brock Hobson, it's not necessarily a normal name. And other than his family, there were only two other instances, if I remember right, where someone got Hobson's name right, the old man in the park and the Sunday school kids. Help me unpack that. Why were people getting his name so wrong?
You know, in comedy, one way to get people to laugh is by having the same thing happen over and over again. And nobody can get Brock's name right. The first person who couldn't get Brock's name right was me. When I was working on this novel, I kept forgetting what his name was. And till finally, I took the expedient of giving him the first name of a dog I once had. A Cairn Terrier named Brock. And then I thought, what's a last name that might be hard to remember? Hobson. It's not like Jack Jones or some ordinary American name. It's a kind of odd name with a lot of consonants in it. I gave him that name as a way of suggesting that he's not quite an ordinary guy.
One of my dearest friends has the last name of Hobson, and I cannot wait to give your book to him. So you include epigraphs at the beginning of each of the three parts of the book, and each was a quote from Eugene Ormandy. Who is Eugene Ormandy, and why were his quotes meaningful to these sections?
Eugene Ormandy was at one time a very well-known orchestral conductor. He conducted the Philadelphia Orchestra in many classic albums that were released on the Columbia label. He was Jewish and originally from Hungary, and he came to this country as a young man. He first worked as a violinist in the Radio City Music Hall Orchestra and worked his way up to this distinguished post as the conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra. The other thing that he was known for is that, maybe second only to, who was it, Joe DiMaggio, I think, he was never entirely comfortable with the English language. So he kept saying things that the musicians in the orchestra would write down because they thought they were so funny. And the novel begins with a quotation from Ormandy: "Who is sitting in that empty chair?" So, I mean, that does two things. First of all, it signals to the reader that I'm writing a comedy. But also, it suggests that the company that you're going to learn about, Generomics, may be illusory, that it may be up to no good. Who is sitting in that empty chair? Well, it turns out Generomics is sitting in that empty chair. But I won't say how or why. It takes the whole novel to reveal that.
Your life and work are associated with a couple of states in the upper Midwest and the Rust Belt, Minnesota and Michigan. But you chose to set Blood Test in Ohio. Why?
You know, sometimes I can explain exactly why I did what I did, and sometimes I can't. In this case, I wanted, what did I want? I wanted to set my novel in the heart of the country. And I have spent time in Ohio. My son lived in Ohio, lived in Cleveland for quite a while. I've driven all around the state. I didn't want to set it in Minnesota because I've done that already. And I didn't want to set it in Michigan because I've done that already. I have to say that the Midwest is my imagination's home. When I close my eyes and I imagine persons, places, and things, I always think of the Midwest because I know how the people here speak and think, particularly the smaller cities in states like Ohio. So that's why I set it there.
Let's get back to your backlist I mentioned earlier. It consists of works of fiction, stories, poetry, prose, essays. How do you decide what to work on at any given time? Do you have ideas just waiting for you to begin?
It's partly that, yes. For years, I taught fiction writing at the University of Michigan and the University of Minnesota. And before that, at Wayne State University in Detroit. And I often came upon ideas when I was teaching that I thought would help my students out. And when I had an occasion to give talks on some feature of the writing of fiction, I would use these ideas that I had come across or my students had come across, and I would write up an essay about it. And so During the time when I was actively teaching fiction, I really alternated between writing fiction and writing essays about the writing of fiction and the form of fiction. And that makes it sound as if all of these things were conscious choices. I think generally, though, that writers write about whatever subject is compelling their attention that has forced itself on them. So when I was working on Blood Test, a comedy, I had this idea about the predictiveness of, let's say, corporations and the internet. And I thought, I've got to write this. And so I just put everything else aside.
We have talked about a lot, but then I also didn't want to spoil anything with the book. Is there anything that you want to talk about with Blood Tests that I haven't asked? Because I haven't even touched on Lena or Pete or I'm blanking on Cheryl. I was blanking on the ex-wife's name.
Cheryl. Well, it's interesting that you have trouble with names because while I'm working on a book, all of these people are like my neighbors. I know them. I can hear them talking. I can see what they're doing. But as soon as I finish writing a book, it's almost like something I've dreamed. And before interviews like this one, I have to go back to the book to remind myself what the characters' names are, what they've done, whom they have fallen in love with. I have to remind myself of all that. I guess the only thing I would mention is that there are a number of minor characters in the book, such as George P. Graham III. And I had always wanted to get into a novel the sort of person who sits down next to you on the bus, or if you're taking an Amtrak train somewhere and you're going in coach, the sort of person who sits down next to you and says, "May I have a moment of your time to talk about current world conditions?" He's that kind of guy. You don't necessarily want to run into people like that on the bus, but I love reading about them. And I love writing the kind of speeches that they have a habit of giving. My son found himself on an Amtrak train, seated next to somebody who began lecturing my son about this guy's left hand, which he had named Seymour. Don't ask me why. And you know, there's a good pedigree in American literature for this kind of character. There's a wonderful Irish writer named Flann O'Brien who has characters like this, and an American author named Charles Portis, who learned a lot from Flann O'Brien and put characters like this in his own books, in True Grit and The Dog of the South. So I have learned from all these people.
Well, he did remember Hobson's name, so we have to give him that credit.
Yeah.
Well, the book is Blood Test, a comedy. Charles Baxter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
That was Charles Baxter, author of the book Blood Test, a comedy, which was published by Pantheon. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Books and Whatnot is a podcast for readers, where we talk about the titles we've read lately and those bookish little discoveries along the way.
You know what, Beth? I have just realized what my favorite new genre is. And my favorite new genre is WTF.
It is.
Listen to Books and Whatnot every month from KMUW, part of the NPR Podcast Network.